Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 14th, and this is our weekly news roundup where we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI. We'll speak with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the island. Cindy, let's start this week with the news that Cape Cod Community College experienced a hack of its computer systems that led to a loss of more than $800,000. You did the initial reporting on this for the paper. Explain what happened at the college. How did this come about?
Well, this is quite a shocker for the college because, of course, it's usually stores and chain stores that are targeted, but was actually targeted at their transaction with the bank. And what happened is that there was an email. It was a suspicious email, but not to the person who opened it at first because it's came from another college, appeared to come from another college. So the person opened it in the administration building. And then when they went to click on the attachment, there was something wonky there. So they immediately did what they were supposed to do and notified the IT team, which came over. It tried to quarantine everything. But by that time, it had spread. They think it was called a polymorphic virus, and it had spread to other machines in the building and specifically was targeting banking transactions.
So it somehow made its way into the system, and at some point the college realized that these banking transactions were compromised.
Yes, well, TD North is their bank, the one who noticed it. There were 12 attempts in all, 9 got through, and that was that added up to $807,000. But what happened was they created like this phony URL, and the people doing the banking thought that they saw the screen and saw the site and thought it was the actual bank site. It interacted with them like the bank site. It even sent them like a phone call, like, you know, when you do a transaction and send you a phone call, and, you know, to so that it was very sophisticated. Yeah, it can be. And the college was trying to, you know, keep one step ahead of viruses like this. They'd actually were installed updating some software, AppGuard, that would protect it against malware like this. But it hadn't got to this part of the building yet.
This is a substantial amount of money for a college like Four Seas, $800,000. I think there's a lot of concern about the impact it could have on the institution.
Yes. Now, the president met with it was a regularly scheduled faculty meeting on Monday. The email went out to faculty a week ago on Friday, and the event itself took place in late November. And but they had a regularly scheduled faculty meeting before the holiday break. And President John Cox informed the faculty that the bills would be paid and they would be paid and that, you know, that was going to go on as usual. They are working closely with the state comptroller's office and the FBI to both recover the money and to protect the college from future attacks.
And the president thinks that they will be able to recover this money.
Yes, they've already recovered at least a quarter of it. They've done that. But they're hoping to recover most, if not all of it. Whether anybody will be prosecuted for this eventually is the big question. You know, are they here in the United States? Where were these hackers based, and who are they? And they're hoping to get all the money back, and if they can, prosecute the perpetrators of this cyber theft, this big cyber theft.
And the college is taking steps now to make sure that something like this doesn't happen.
Yes,
again.
They've removed all the infected hard drives, and they've installed this. They've rolled out across the campus this new protection.
I want to bring in Sarah Mises-Tan, WCAI's lead reporter. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Sarah, offshore wind is one of your beats. A couple of pieces of news this week. First has to do with what are called transit corridors through the proposed wind farms. The company Vineyard Wind made an announcement that prompted some outcry from fishermen. Explain what happened here.
Yeah, there was a little kerfluffle earlier this week. Vineyard Wind made an announcement that they were endorsing a 2-mile-wide transit zone. Those are the paths that fishermen will be able to use transiting the offshore wind farms when they all are developed. But fishermen say that that was a worst-case scenario. They say that they would prefer 4-mile-wide corridors.
So you can imagine a giant wind farm, and this is a corridor right through the middle for boats to pass, and they're typically using this to get out to their fishing grounds?
Yeah, most of these fishermen, they're trawlers, and so they're towing a lot of gear behind them. They're pretty big boats, and it's pretty hard to maneuver them. I know some people would say 2 miles wide seems so wide. I can't even envision that. 4 miles wide, what does that even look like? But for fishermen, it makes a big difference in terms of what type of margin of error they have when navigating.
And Vineyard Wind saying that 2 miles wide, they chose that because of why? It was, where did that number come from?
Yeah, they Vineyard Wind kind of has passed the blame here. They say that 2 miles wide corridors are something that the Coast Guard has approved previously, and the Coast Guard approved that after meetings with fisheries, and that was the agreed upon transit corridor width. And so Vineyard Wind says it's not them, they're just endorsing a plan that had already been put out there.
This is all part of a bigger discussion right now, because it's not just about Vineyard Wind's lease parcel that they're looking to develop, start building out on by, 2019. It's also about these other lease parcels that it's proposed to be an immense wind farm off the East Coast here, south of Martha's Vineyard, and how fishermen are going to navigate through wind farms that haven't even been built or designed yet.
Definitely. So we've heard that Vineyard Wind's plot in the ocean is actually not necessarily even in those transit zone areas. Mm-hmm. And so they might actually have the least amount of impact on this anyways. But yeah, it is 1,400 miles of potential wind farms out in the ocean that is in the area of fishermen who transit that area. And so absolutely, as more wind farms come online, that width of a corridor is definitely going to make a difference.
1,400 square miles of potential wind farms out there. Kind of brings us to our second piece of news of the week, which is that a big auction was held. It started yesterday. It's still going on, I guess, on several more parcels of ocean south of Martha's Vineyard to become new wind farms. We were watching this in the newsroom yesterday, and we were surprised by how high the numbers went here, and I mean the prices that people were bidding for these leases.
Yeah, so the federal government has they're leasing 3 additional areas out near adjacent to Vineyard Wind's plot of ocean south of Nantucket, and bids started at about $250,000, and we watched as the bidding rounds continued that they climbed to about $90 million is where things ended, and the auction actually closed for the day, and it's opening at 9 a.m. It has opened, and so they're continuing to take bids. I saw that one of the plots has actually reached $101 million at this point.
Okay, I get the prize because I said it was going to go over $100 million, so I'm very pleased by that. So this is our 3 plots, each of them now in excess of $90 million or so. At close of business day yesterday, the 3 plots together were worth about $285 million. Just to give us some sense of scale of how rapidly the wind industry is really becoming a realistic idea around here, a couple of years ago, Vineyard Wind had their lease auction and got their property, their lease area, for how much?
I believe it was $280,000, so very close to the starting bid price for these plots, which is absolutely insane. We spoke with some experts yesterday during all of this, before it had even reached $90 million, and they had said that this shows that there is absolutely increased interest in offshore wind development, especially off of Massachusetts, given what the Massachusetts government has, or the governor has mandated, and just the fact that the state already has a contract with an offshore wind farm that's gearing up to get online by the end of this year.
Really, when you think back to 2015, I think when Vineyard Wind got their lease area, and the idea of building a wind farm, I think everyone was still so jangled from coming out of the Cape Wind experience. A lot of people weren't sure how viable it is. Now, here we are 3.5 years later, and it's obviously something that everyone is leaning into and thinking this is going to happen, and it's going to be huge for the East Coast here.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely a lot of confidence in the industry right now, just given that you can see how much money these companies are putting down just for a lease area. So there's definitely some thought that with Vineyard Wind leading the charge next year, that's kind of going to create a domestic supply chain that will then make it much easier for other companies to get on board.
WCAI lead reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thank you for that.
Thanks.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, the Kmart Plaza in Hyannis is going to be redeveloped. We've talked about this a bit on the roundup this week. Town of Barnstable announced that they're announced their choice for what to have happen there. Tell us about what's coming to this plaza.
Okay, well, this is also known as Cape Town Plaza, but yet it is better known as the Kmart Plaza because of its big anchor store. And this is the town of Barnstable is interested. They recommended to award a long-term lease to WS Development, and that would develop 300,000 square feet of the property, and it would be would be a bit of a facelift for the property. The idea is not to have it look like the strip mall. It would have shops, restaurants, entertainment, and open space, and it would be known as The Landing.
This is a really big deal, what they're proposing. They also have some ideas for housing on this site.
Yeah, the developer said that they would consider housing. The developer said they would consider housing for the site, and if it wasn't suitable, they said they would give $2.5 million to the Housing Assistance Corporation in Hyannis. That's the nonprofit housing agency, and over 11 years.
Right now, that property, I think people think about it, there's a lot of asphalt there. What they're proposing is kind of a different vision for what it could be.
Yeah, definitely. They would have the ideas to have walking paths, and there would be a village green, and a children's play area that would even be converted to a skating rink in the winter. So this would be something that they envision as drawing the community together and providing recreation as well as shopping and dining experiences. And offices. There could be office space there, too.
This was one of two proposals that were put forward for this property. And in the end, they went with this one, I think, because it had a higher financial offering involved and it made sense for the town that way. The other proposal, a competing developer, I think was disappointed. The developer that they're going forward with on this, turns out this is the developer who already owns the property already or already holds the lease for this property.
And WS Development is also pretty well known. They developed Wareham Crossing and Derby Street in Hingham, which is a real type of destination place. And right now, the Barnstable Municipal Airport is in charge of this property, but it will be up to the town to actually go forward and award the contract to WS Development. And this is an expensive project. It's $45 million. And this is like on 26 acres in total.
And the lease is worth, I think it's worth $131 million over a pretty long period of time.
Right.
It's a
49-year, $131 million lease. It's worth quite a bit of money to whoever develops this property. And there are other stores and restaurants there whose future is kind of up in the air. For instance, the Old Navy store and the Tiki Port restaurant, which some people might not realize is part of this parcel, but it actually is part of this parcel. And their future is kind of up in the air at this point.
I thought it was interesting that the proposal that won here that we're talking about is called The Landing. And the reason it's called The Landing is because it's related to the airport that owns and controls the property.
That controls the property. That's right.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now from the Vineyard Gazette is Bill Evel. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Bill, an iconic island farm in Chilmark has been sold. Tell us about the farm and what we know about the new owners and what we know about what may happen on this property.
Yeah, it's a really cool story. I mean, any real estate story here is big news. But this is, as you said, an iconic farm. It's called Beetlebunk Farm, and it just sold for $2.4 million. It was put on the market earlier this fall, and it's only 5.7 acres, so it's not a huge property. But it sits right at the center of Chilmark, and it's visible from all the roads, and has this really wonderful family farming history. It's been farmed for years by the Fisher family, first by Ozzie Fisher, then his daughter Marie took over, then his grandson Chris did it, and more recently his granddaughter Lydia. So it's been in farming and the family for a long time and part of the community. It's actually interesting. Beetlebunk Farm and Beetlebunk Corner, where it sits, got its name from the trees there, beetlebunk trees, which are not called beetlebunk trees anywhere else. They're called tupelo trees, but it's a really hard wood, and they used to make the beetle, which is a mallet, and the bung, which is sort of the nub that they would lodge into the whaling barrel, so it became Beetlebunk Tree. A little bit of trivia there.
History. I like it.
But yeah, but anyway, so there was a lot of worry about what would happen to the farm when it went on the market. As I said, it's visible from all the roads. Even the town of Chilmark was thinking of buying it, and they did put in a bid, actually, at $2.4 million. But the family went with a nonprofit called the Farm Group, which is headed up by John and Amy Weinberg, seasonal residents here. And what they've decided to do is they're going to make it, keep it a farm, but they're also going to create a sort of a learning farm area. So that's still being developed, how that's going to pan out, but they really want to keep it as part of the community and create sort of an environmental learning area and farming for the community. So it really is one of those great good stories, because you never know when things go on the market what's going to happen to it. But this looks like, at least in the early stages, it will remain part of the community and remain what it is, and that's a beautiful, iconic farm.
And you detail a little bit about how the Fisher family has been working this for quite a long time.
Yeah, it's great how it's gone through the generations, from patriarch to daughter to grandson to granddaughter. Chris Fisher, the grandson, he started farming there, and he actually then became a cook using all of the ingredients there for local restaurants and wrote a James Beard award-winning cookbook, the Beetlebunk Farm Cookbook, a few years back, and now it's passed on to the granddaughter, Lydia. So it's really been steeped in the family, and they always had a farm stand, so everybody sort of, you know, the community's been coming and going on that farm for a long time, so it's really great news that it will continue to do so.
Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a great week.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, two of the Cape's nonprofit hospice organizations are merging. What's the story here?
Well, Cape Cod Healthcare, that's the parent company of Cape Cod and Falmouth Hospitals, is taking over the Hope Health Hospice Services on the Cape and Martha's Vineyard. And they say that they're going to immediately start enrolling patients in Cape Cod Healthcare's hospice program, which is the Visiting Nurse Association of Cape Cod Hospice Program.
The transition here, I'm sure they're working to make this a smooth transition and make this all come together.
Yeah, the word that they're using is seamless. They want to make it as seamless as possible. And they're also calling it a consolidation, and it's going to take place. They said it won't be really official till February 1st. But one of the things they have to do, Cape Cod Healthcare has to do, is get a license to operate the inpatient Mary McCarthy it's now called the McCarthy Care Center in Sandwich. It's named after Mary McCarthy, the nurse who founded Hospice of Cape Cod in the early 1980s. That's the only inpatient hospice facility on the Cape, and it's been struggling with a low census. And when I talked to Diana Franchitto, she's the CEO of Hope Health, which is based in Providence, Rhode Island, she said that the talks really heated up or got underway over concern about the care center, how, you know, both parties wanted to make sure that this was open and available to Cape Codders. So Cape Cod Healthcare has to get a license for that, and they also have to decide to do what to do with the 70 employees who work on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard for Hope Health. And the executives say that, and they said in a joint press release that they hope to absorb most, if not all of them, into the Cape Cod Healthcare Organization.
Why is this happening? What's happening in the hospice world that these are merging?
Well, the interesting thing is that there's so much more interest in hospice. This is the baby boom generation getting older and their parents getting older, and they want alternatives to the traditional way of dying in hospitals or dying in pain. They want hospice services, and they want the spiritual and physical comfort that comes with hospice. So when Hospice of Cape Cod, which was the original, which Hope Health was originally, started, it was the only game in town on Cape Cod, but now there are about at least half a dozen other organizations that are for-profit. They're for-profit organizations, and that's according to Medicare. And there are a couple also of nonprofits. There's one, Cranberry, which is run by Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, also advertises that it's here on the Cape. So there's a heck of a lot of competition out there for the services. Now, the VNA has 100 patients. Michael Loft, the CEO of Cape Cod Healthcare, president and CEO, said the VNA has about 100 hospice patients, as well as Hope Health has 100 hospice patients. So this has this could double the amount of patients that the VNA is taking care of, the hospice patients.
And Hope Health has an office in Hyannis. Do they know what's going to happen with some of that?
Michael Loft said that they're undecided. I know it's not a sure thing it's going to close, but they're going to determine what to do about that. And they said that the fate of the employees should be, you know, kind of sorted out within the next 6 weeks. Now, Hope Health, it's interesting. the Cape Hospice Organization, the Hope Health. It became Hope Health. It was Hospice of Cape Cod, Hospice and Palliative Care of Cape Cod, and then it became Hope Health. When it merged in 2015 with this larger organization in Rhode Island, the larger organization took on its name, actually, which is interesting. And they are going to continue their – at that time, they said, we're going to expand, we're going to make it bigger and stronger, but that didn't happen. And actually, they had layoffs, about 30 people within the last 2 years, including 18 this year. And the V&A also had to lay off 8 people this year. So there's this competition, there is this changing world that they're facing, but Hope Health will continue to have operations in Rhode Island, the greater Boston area, and southeastern Massachusetts. It's the Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard portion that they are handing over to Cape Cod Healthcare.
Let's talk about this needle exchange program, which is set to open in Falmouth. What can you tell us about this?
Well, this is the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod plans to open a syringe exchange in East Falmouth. It's for injection drug users, and they can turn in their used needles for new ones. And it'll be a healthcare facility as well. They'll also do screenings for hepatitis, HIV, other sexually transmitted diseases. This is also a place where people can go to obtain the overdose reversal medication Narcan and other services and get training too, and using the Narcan.
They're also going to be providing counseling services here?
Yeah, that's for people who want counseling. Joseph Carleo, who's the president and CEO of the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, said that, you know, if the client wants assistance, that they will be more than willing to, you know, to link them with recovery services and everything. But this is not a place where people will go in and, you know, just say, you have to do this. It's like they're trying to make it an open and accessible place where people can go in and get their healthcare needs taken care of and create this opportunity for people to also who want to get clean to get clean.
What kind of response has there been to the idea of a needle exchange program opening in Falmouth?
You know, there hasn't been a heck of a lot of pushback from the community. It's unlike in Barnstable, where this is a big issue. The needle exchange has created some issues about discarded needles being found near playgrounds or playing fields and that sort of thing. Where in it seems though in in Falmouth that it's going forward, and the Falmouth Board of Health did write a letter of support, and that's a requirement for them for the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod to receive state funding for the syringe exchange program. The health board members in Falmouth gave them unanimous support, and they say there's been no negative response from the public yet, according to Falmouth health agent, that's Scott McGann. And he said it's the job of the Board of the Health to prevent disease. And it's interesting because the one in Hyannis does not get this state aid. It has to be privately funded because it's not supported by the Barnstable Public Health Division. It is much more of a controversy in Barnstable. And we'll see what happens in Falmouth. But so far, it looks like, you know, fair sailing for the needle exchange, which will open at 178 East Falmouth Highway, which is across from St. Anthony's Church.
We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. And hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Casey, a couple of months ago, we talked about a figure in Provincetown who found himself homeless, Freddie Rocha. You have kind of a check back in with him this week, and it highlights really the difficulties in navigating support services for someone like Freddie and on the Outer Cape in particular.
Yeah, Freddie Rocha has been a fixture of the Provincetown streets for over 40 years. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia many years ago, but over the years, he's broken down barriers about mental illness as he's become so familiar with all the residents here. It's kind of just become one of those colors of the rainbow that makes Provincetown the special place that it is. About 3 months ago, Freddie's siblings evicted him from his family home because they could no longer afford to keep the house where Freddie's lived for most of his life and where he's lived by himself for the past few years since his mother went into a nursing home. So a friend of his who's been photographing him for a few years named David Chick decided to take him in and give him a place to stay in Provincetown and try to get him a permanent roof over his head as well as some services, which he really needs at this age. He's 67 and he's living alone with a major mental illness. And David doesn't want to do this full time. His career is really in Los Angeles. And anyway, he just was hoping he could set Freddie Rocha up with some services and a house. And this has turned out to be very difficult. Even though in 2016, the town of Provincetown gave $100,000 to Outer Cape Health Services as an annual line item to create this thing called the Navigator Program. The Navigator Program is aims to reach hard-to-help people, people maybe with co-occurring mental health and substance abuse disorders who live on the Outer Cape where there are so few services. And the concept of the Navigator Program, anyway, has really caught on, and it's got the support of Truro, Wellfleet, and Eastham, who now each contribute $25,000 apiece every year for the Navigator Program. And then the other towns on the Outer Cape also contribute smaller amounts of money. But what's become apparent from our ability to be up close and personal in one personal story, usually HIPAA laws prevent the public from really getting to know a specific case, David Chick's been very public about talking about Freddie's story, and so has his family too. I mean, his sister was very open. So getting to look at this one up close and personal story, what you quickly learn is that navigation is really just the beginning, and not the most critical part of what's needed. Navigators cannot create affordable housing, for example, and they found in their own report there's a 2 to 10 year wait list for affordable housing on Cape Cod. And navigators also can't create congregate living situations for people with special needs, and that's something else that's desperately needed, as they also say in their own reporting. What David Chick has found is that navigators are often navigating to nowhere, or they're navigating off Cape, and they're certainly navigating out of Provincetown, and that's really heartbreaking for Freddie, because this is the one place where he really wanted to stay. It's his lifetime home. So even with this one person, kind of remarkably, this Good Samaritan, David Chick, putting his life on hold and really working full-time to hook him up with services and meeting with every human service agency that he possibly can, it looks very possible that a 67-year-old man that many people know and love who has schizophrenia will not be able to stay in Provincetown and may be homeless.
It sounded from your article as if Freddie Rocha, one of the challenges facing him right now is that he is doing so well, that David Chick has really embraced him and helped to get him into a very good place. But that means that his situation in light of the people who would help him is not regarded as dire.
Right. From what I've looked at in my reporting is that the situation is so much more desperate than what the public really sees, that somebody even as, you know, vulnerable as Freddie, now that he even has a temporary place to stay and someone who's temporarily helping him, puts him in such a better place than other people, and that the healthcare system is so fragmented and so weak, I guess, that they have to prioritize in a very harsh way. Larry Marsland, who's the head of the Outreach Council, he said it's a cold, hard world, and the public just doesn't get it. They just don't realize how difficult it is.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Okay, thank you.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, a Mashpee school was closed for 3 days this week after high carbon monoxide levels were reported.
Yeah, it was on Tuesday that the leak was discovered. The officials detect the school was actually evacuated by 9:50 a.m. And this was carbon monoxide levels reached as high as 300 parts per million, which emergency personnel said is quite dangerous. Students were initially brought into the gym while firefighters ventilated the building. And this all occurred from a gas leak in the boiler room.
This was the Quashnet school.
This is the Quashnet school, sorry. Yeah. The Quashnet school. So there were actually three work, and this was in the kitchen area. The kitchen area is near the boiler room, and this leak originated in the boiler room. And three workers were affected. One was taken to the hospital feeling unwell. One got to the hospital on their own, and the third was treated at the scene.
Now, they worked hard to try to get this back together quickly, but apparently it eluded them a little bit what to do here.
Yeah, they thought things were repaired, but then in a check on Wednesday morning, Deputy Fire Chief John Phelan said that, it was the Fire Chief, Thomas Rullo, was checking out the building Wednesday morning before the school started just to make sure, but they found that the carbon monoxide levels were rising in the room where the boiler room had just been repaired, and students were on the way to school at this point, and they were not allowed in. They were sent home on the bus, and if there was no adult available to meet them, they were brought to the Mashpee Middle High School for the rest of the day.
So this was Tuesday and Wednesday. Yesterday, they was still out as they were checking to make sure that everything was really in hand.
Yeah, they just didn't want to have a repeat performance of what happened on Wednesday. So and so they were. It was just to continue to monitor the situation. And a Facebook post on Thursday night from the school district said that air quality levels of the building have been stable, and there's been no evidence of this carbon monoxide or natural gas since Wednesday. But they really just wanted to make sure. And the fire department installed carbon monoxide detectors in the mechanical areas of the building, also in the hallways near the boiler room.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
George, a meeting in West Tisbury yesterday brought together folks to hear an update on the drinking water contamination by the airport. This is the result of chemicals used in firefighting foam, which the airport uses in case of an aircraft fire. Tell us about the meeting and what we've learned about the response so far to this water contamination.
Yeah, so this meeting... I would call this the second stage of finding out contamination. There was a little bit more frustration expressed at yesterday's meeting at what some people say is a delay in letting people know about this issue. The investigation began last spring. There were some tests done at the airport over the summer. The results came in July, and the elevated levels on airport property were known in July, and so some people in the neighborhood who have had elevated levels themselves are asking why they didn't know about it back in July when these results came in at the airport. And it was interesting, the airport consultant did have some difficulty answering that question, and commissioners later on, after the room had cleared out, said, you know, we need to give people a better answer to that. That was part of the meeting. Obviously, there were about 50 people there, many of them West Tisbury residents, some of them outside of the area of concern. But what they wanted to know is, you know, if you find some samples on the outer fringes, are you going to expand this? And the airport officials said they would. Another interesting thing that came up, again, after the room cleared out, was this all comes at a price. The airport decided to do this investigation on their own before it was mandated, and so they've hired this consultant, Tetra Tech, and the initial investigation was, like, you know, in the under 20,000 range, but they're now saying that because of the wide net that they're casting here, they need $105,000 to keep Tetra Tech going through the end of January. So a lot more than that initial price of 20. It was actually under $20,000. So, you know, airport commissioners are saying, are we going to try and seek reimbursement from the FAA? And the airport management said, absolutely. As people may or may not know, this firefighting foam is mandated by the FAA. So the airport, as long as they're going to have the types of aircraft that they have landing and taking off at Martha's Vineyard Airport right now, the FAA says you have to have this firefighting foam on hand. So, you know, we're still in the very, very early stages of this. And there's a lot of moving parts, but there was a DEP official there yesterday, you know, trying to calm some of the fears that people have. As he said, you know, this is about consumption of the water over a long, long period of time. He said that health risks that are out there assume that you're drinking this water every single day, 2 liters of it over a long period of time, in order to have some of these health effects that you know, they suggest. So, you know, the health risk may not be as bad as people think. A lot of people, of course, you know, for other reasons, have decided, you know, that bottled water is the way to go. But the airport also is for those places, and there are, you know, a handful of them so far that have elevated levels off airport property. They are supplying bottled water at this point, and long-term solutions are down the road once they know the full extent of how far this contamination has migrated off airport property.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for the update.
Thanks so much, Steve, and have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, health insurance costs continue rising, and it's having a real impact for the Cape with its many small and medium-sized businesses.
Well, the Commonwealth Fund issued a report last week, and that's a private nonprofit group based out of New York City, and they issued a report for the nation that showed that employer-sponsored health plans are rising faster than the cost of employer-sponsored health plans is rising faster than workers' wages. And no surprise to people on Cape Cod, and local people. This report was not broken down by county. It was broken down by state. But I talked to some people on the Cape who at the Chamber of Commerce, an insurance broker, who said it probably looks even worse for the Cape. And they said, and this is a concern because the vast majority of people under 65, 152 million of them, get insurance through their employer. And Dr. David Blumenthal, who's the Commonwealth Fund president, said many of them can barely afford to pay for it.
The premiums in the state going up and in our region, why does it particularly affect this medium and small businesses that the Cape has?
Well, they don't have the bargaining power that the large employer organizations have. And the Cape is full of all these small businesses. This is, you know, 1 to 49 employees. And this is John Turco, who's from Rogers & Gray, said that's an issue on Cape Cod. Well, Massachusetts, the premiums are very high anyway nationwide. This study looked, the Commonwealth study, looked at the rates going up from over various years. And the last year for which they had figure was 2017. And Massachusetts in 2017 was one of eight states where the single-person premium from employer plans rose above $7,000, and then one of seven where family premiums were $20,000 or higher, which was $21,053. One of the interesting things is that in Massachusetts, when you look at the employee share of the premium and the deductibles, the potential deductibles, the out-of-pocket spending by the employee and their family comes to about 8% of the median income, which is less than the nationwide rate of 12% and even less than what employees shoulder in Louisiana and Mississippi, which is they could potentially – these costs could potentially consume 15% or more of their median income. And the difference is in Massachusetts, even though deductibles have been going up, they haven't been going up as high as they have been in some of these southern states. And also the median income in Massachusetts is higher than it is in these other states. Of course, the question is Cape Cod. Cape Cod doesn't have a particularly high median income. So it'd be interesting to find out what the rates were on Cape Cod. Now, Wendy Northcross from the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce said that they got sticker shock in fiscal 2018 when their premiums went up to almost 24%. Mm. They got a bit of a break for fiscal 2019 when it went up less than 1%. But still, you know, coming even less than 1% on top of a 24% increase, that's really huge.
Well, she says in the article that when somebody left the chamber, they didn't replace the position because that money in the end went to pay for the
increase in
health insurance costs.
Other businesses are facing this too. And John Turco said that employers are continually increasing continuing to pass on this cost to employees as well. He said they're increasing the employee share of the premium at rates of 6 to 10% per year. Now, one of the suggestions from the Commonwealth Fund, they had several suggestions. One thing was to control healthcare costs. Okay. And that's been debated for a very long time. But the other thing is to get rid of something called the family glitch when you go for subsidized care. Because people who are on an employer plan that consumes too much of their income, let's say over 9.5%, are entitled to apply for subsidized care, you know, either MassHealth or one of the subsidized connector care programs. But that's only based on them as a single person, looking at them on like a single plan. So if you are responsible for children or a spouse, and then your health care, your premium shoots up through the roof, they don't consider that. You know what I mean? The additional members of the family aren't considered. So some people are like, oh yeah, I definitely, you know, would qualify for this subsidized care. And then it's like, no, you would, but if you weren't, but you know, we can't add your family onto this. So if Congress would fix this, a lot more people could go onto those subsidized plans, and that would help relieve some of the burden on the individual paying it.
A new report on whale entanglement is getting mixed reviews from scientists. Tell us about the report and what it says.
Well, this is the first national report of large whale entanglements off the U.S., and this was done by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But what this does is, and Scott Landry, he's the director of the Marine Animal Disentanglement at the Center for Coastal Studies, said that this is a good way to explain the problem to lay people. But what it really does is it relies on reports of people happening to come across whale entanglements. If you're out, if you're a recreational boater, if you're a whale boat captain, if you are on a commercial fishing vessel and you see a whale entanglement, it relies, you can report this. And so that's, it's a good tool in some ways because it makes people aware. But it, but other researchers say it's not scientific. I mean, there's so many, looking at the scarring on whales, they can tell that there are so many more entanglements out there. For instance, this says that there were 76 large whale entanglements confirmed in 2017 off U.S. coasts. And however, others say that it's actually, you know, there are probably seven, and that 49 of them were humpback whales. But a researcher said that it was critical of the report, or not critical, but pointing out some of the issues with it. So there are probably 700 to 1,600 humpback entanglements in 2017 when you look at the scarring, if you do like a, if you have more of a scientific approach. But this is also raising awareness among people, and people are looking for it now. And so this is, it makes people aware of the problems and the need for things like for ropeless fishing gear and other mechanisms to free whales from the things that are harming them and injuring them, and maybe helping to bring down birth rates, too, of whales.
And one of the things that the scientists are pointing out here is that there's probably an overrepresentation of humpback entanglements here because a lot of the reports are coming from whale-watching boats, and they're typically out there where the humpbacks are, and that's what they're looking for.
Right, that's exactly what they're looking for. But Scott Landry did say that when you look at the humpback entanglements, 49, and compare it to the endangered North Atlantic right whale, which had only two, he said it still comes to 15% of each population because the right whale population is so small. But yes, this is sort of what, you know, people are looking for. People are looking for the humpback whales.
I want to skip ahead here to a story about, there's been a lot of talk about ways to make our beaches safer for sharks. And recently there was a demonstration of drone technology at Nauset Beach. And it was an interesting glimpse into one possible approach on this.
Yeah, well, this is the officials from the Cape Cod National Seashore and area beach managers for the towns have been definitely looking into drone technology as a way to look down from above and spot these sharks. And But the issue is cost and how much this is a labor-intensive thing, having someone looking at the screen and then how much area that they're going to cover. But this Australia-based company demonstrated drone technology and software that was at Nauset Beach in Orleans on Monday for seashore and officials and public safety officials from the Cape. What's interesting is this uses artificial intelligence to scan the waters. Mm-hmm. And so the drone is up there recording this thing. If I see a bird, and it learns to do this. So if it sees a surfer, it'll be a surfer when it has the shark, when it has a special shark recognition software. And then it'll recognize the shark. And then that will alert a person, that will alert the pilot to take a closer look if a shark pops up. And that's to reduce the exhaustion level of the person viewing the screen. And also that would bring down the labor intensity of the drone.
Now, this is already being deployed in Australia in parts along the coast.
Yeah, this is it's in Australia, and let's see, it's in Little Ripper drones, and they're at 15 beaches in Queensland and New South Wales in Australia, and more on the way in Australia in 2019. They say they're going to roll it across the country, and this is this was demoed Monday with funding from the Ripper Group and by the University of Technology researchers Michael Blumenstein and Nabin Sharma, and they so basically it's kind of like Alexa, the as it interacts, it becomes more sophisticated in what it recognizes. Just as Alexa recognizes individual family voices, mm-hmm. then this drone will become increasingly sophisticated and also be programmed, but become increasingly sophisticated as it actually learns.
It's not inexpensive, and it sounds like the feeling right now is that we're not quite ready to go there with the Cape beaches.
Yeah, Suzanne Grout-Thomas, who is a Wellfleet Beach administrator, said that the drones are phase two of any safety project. Phase one is improving communication at the beaches, which is hugely important because of the two recent shark attacks this summer. The last one was fatal at Wellfleet in September. There was problems with people calling for help on their cell phones and being able to get a signal. So she says that you need these hardwired 911 phone boxes and better cell phone coverage, and that's the first thing.
I want to talk about an article that you did earlier about a local group that supports members of the military. Had a surprising visit from a notable person at a recent holiday event. Tell us about
this. Yeah, well, Cape Cod Cares for the Troops. It's a wonderful organization here, homegrown here on the Cape. They provide care packages for the troops, and they do this annual Christmas party at Fort Belvoir in Virginia, which is where wounded soldiers are recovering. And so they've done this for 10 years. But this time, there was not just Santa. Vice President Mike Pence and his wife, Karen, made an unexpected visit. Michelle Da Silva, who with her son Dylan founded Cape Cod Cares for the Troops, knew about it. But she thought it was up in the air because of with the funeral of President Bush and everything. Mm-hmm. She thought that was. But then she got a call. The party with Santa was Saturday, and she got a call from Pence's officials at the White House on Friday that this was going to happen. So people were a little bit. They suspected something was in the air just because of all the security that suddenly came on the scene and everything. But then it was a surprise when the vice president showed up with his wife, Karen, and he stayed for about an hour and a half, posed for pictures with every table, every soldier. His wife gave out bracelets to the spouses and caregivers, and they had other little memorabilia, little coins and books and toys for the children, as well as the children getting so many toys from Cape Codders and bicycles. And the families also received Christmas wreaths from the Barnstable County Sheriff's Department and quilts from the Harwich Quilt Bank, and it was about 270 people were at the Christmas party, and also soldiers and their spouses or caregivers picked up toys for the children also to put under their Christmas tree because a lot of them have financial difficulties as they're in the process of recovering.
Now, before we wrap up, I want to talk about rabbits. A small island off Martha's Vineyard is getting a startup population of New England's only native cottontail rabbit. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, this will be 10 bunnies who will be released on no man's land. That's an island off Aquinnah that used to be used as a naval bombing practice site. But now it's going to be made safe for the bunnies. It is a bird sanctuary, and these bunnies are scheduled to arrive in April. Yeah, they are New England cottontails, and I was surprised to hear that they were rare because you see the bunnies, but I guess maybe those are the eastern cottontails with which they are in competition. And these little bunnies will wear GPS collars, and they're expected that to go from 10 to 600 in a short period of time. You know, the rabbit jokes and everything. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says that this is a good location because the New England cottontail rabbits prefer younger forests, like thickets of young trees, shrublands, and coastal barrens. And what's happening through most of New England is that we don't have this young forest anymore. We have development, and that the trees that remain are older, taller trees, and they like, to be down low and protected. And so we'll see what happens.
And there is unexploded ordnance on the island, but they say that the rabbit's weight isn't heavy enough to trigger the unexploded ordnance.
Yeah. They better keep their weight down. They should eat to be healthy, but not to be fat little bunnies.
Cindy, you have a story coming out this weekend in the Cape Cod Times on Sunday. You want to tell us what you've been working on?
Well, I'm doing a story about about senior citizens during the holidays and how this can be a particularly lonely time for people who have family who are far away and they might not be spending the holidays with them. And also there is something called an elder orphan, which is when you have really no living family members. And this is a particular concern for organizations on the Cape Cod. Police departments are delivering presents, councils on aging hold parties. There's a special gift collection that goes on the Cape. for it's by a senior care organization, and they actually have a gift drive for elders where they have little trees with ornaments and banks and things. You could pick out, just like we would for a child, you can pick out a senior citizen's name and see what they want. Sometimes they want hard candy that's, you know, sugar-free hard candy, slippers, or a shawl or something like that.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Cindy, for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And our other contributors, we spoke with Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI, Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.